Tahura ki Gulf Marine Park, ko te pātaka kai o Tikapa Moana, te Moana Nui Atoi, is 1.2 million hectares in size with more than 40 pest-free islands and 6 marine reserves. This seascape lies on the east coast of the Tāmaki Makaurau and Waikato regions, stretching down to the eastern coastline of the Coromandel Peninsula to Waihi. Kia ora, I'm Kiane Matatasipu, the host of Hauraki Gulf Kōrero, a podcast established by the Hauraki Gulf Forum. Here you will be introduced to kaitiaki of Te Moana Nui Atoi, Tikapa Moana, to discuss the state of the Gulf, and explore the many ways in which these groups and individuals are taking action to achieve a healthy, thriving marine environment. Kia ora koutou, welcome back to another episode of the Hauraki Gulf Kōrero. Today in the whare we have two people who come from fairly different backgrounds. So we have Rochelle and Matt, who are here today to talk to us about the Brutus whales. And I'm going to flip it straight over to them to introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about who they are and what they do. So let's start with you, Rochelle.
Kia ora. So I'm a marine scientist. I work at the University of Auckland. And I guess I've slowly become someone who mostly is focused on trying to find solutions to wicked conservation problems in the marine space. Most of my work is with really large animals, whales, dolphins, sharks, seabirds. I grew up by the beach. I'm a beach kid. I spend a lot of time at sea. And so for me, it's just a place that if I'm too far away from this, I get really nervous and I sort of get a bit shifty if I'm on land for too long. I think because New Zealand, Aotearoa, is a marine nation, everyone who came here by the sea, and we are very connected to it. Our country is 93% ocean, and so we have a lot of issues that need talking about and we need to come together. So those are my main drivers, I guess. You know, I'm connected to the sea as a child, and now as an adult I am too.
And what about you, Matt? Tell us a little bit about where you're from and your involvement, or your mahi and your involvement with the Moana.
Yeah, kia ora koutou. Hey, I'm a New Aucklander, if you like. I've been here about 8 years, since 2012. Moved here from London, but I'm originally from Napier. And yeah, grew up there, and I've sort of lived all over the world. I fetched up in Auckland and started working for the port. So I'm the communications manager or head of comms, whatever you want to call it, at Ports of Auckland. It's a funny old job, you know. I've worked for infrastructure companies doing communications around the world, but nothing like Ports of Auckland. I mean, I've been involved in everything from your normal comms with media and community, but we also do events. We do lots of big sponsorships, and we do really interesting and wonderful things like working with Rochelle to help save some Brutus whales. And yeah, it's a fantastic job. I love this industry. There's a lot of seafaring in my history, even though I wasn't a great sailor or anything like that. But it seems to have come out here, and I've found my feet here at the port and working on the Hauraki Gulf.
I'm really interested in the pairing of how you two both came together to create this kaupapa around protecting and saving, I guess, Brutus whales. I also just want to point out before we carry on the kōrero that for those who are listening, if you hear a little bit of a funny sound or funny sounds as we're speaking, the three of us are having this interview via Zoom. Good old COVID has meant we can't meet together ātinana in person. However, we are still able to record this. So just in case you're thinking there's a bit of a crackly sound every now and again, that's just because we're on Zoom. So can you both tell me, what is it that you do with Brutus whales? Like, what are Brutus whales and what's their significance to the Hauraki Gulf?
Brutus whales are an unusual whale. They're a baleen whale, so they filter their food, mostly eating fish and plankton. And most baleen whales migrate to the polar regions, either Arctic or Antarctic, in the summer, and then they feed and then they swim back to the warm tropical regions in the winter to breed. Not Brutus whales. They like it sort of, you know, warmish year round. So for us in the Hauraki Gulf, we're really lucky. We have one of only about three resident year-round resident populations of brooders whales. So they're there all the time, you know, and which is incredibly lucky. They've always been there. They've been there long before we arrived in New Zealand, and they actually have a pretty productive habitat. So the Hauraki Gulf is a really large embayment with a lot of islands in it, but it's quite shallow. It's around about 50 metres deep. So we have up north, up near the Bay of Islands in sort of northeastern New Zealand, cold water comes up and over the continental shelf, and then it runs along, you know, the seabed, if you can imagine, down towards the Hauraki Gulf. And then we get these warm water comes down in the summer months with the East Auckland current that peels off. And with that, it brings all kinds of like the marlin and the tunas and all kinds of warm water species come down. But once it hits the Gulf, it's quite a windy place. So there's we get this wind mixed environment. So the cold water at the bottom and the warm water at the top gets mixed around. And that mixture of cold and warm makes lots of productivity, lots of phytoplankton, which is the beginning of the food chain. And then you get zooplankton and fish. So the Hauraki Gulf is an incredibly productive place, lots and lots of food for lots of different animals. And we have around about 20% of the world's known, you know, whale and dolphin species have been in the Gulf at some point. I think about something around a quarter of the known seabird species in the world have been in the Hauraki Gulf, which gives you an idea of how rich it is in food and habitat and everything these big animals need. So the whales have been here for a long time, and they live a great life there. They mostly feed on fish historically, but that switched in the last 10 years to feeding on zooplankton, which is indicative of some of the changes that may be going on in the Gulf. But it supports these big whales. They're about 15 metres long. They're probably about 25 tonnes in weight, so they're not little. Wow. Yeah, they eat a lot. And they're kind of an unusual whale as well, because they live in a place that has daytime, nighttime, year-round. And these whales, they feed in the day, and then when the sun goes down, they're like, oh, not nice. They go to sleep and they have a rest at night, and then they wake up in the morning and they start feeding again and other things. So that's really unusual for big baleen whales, you know, but they feed year round. So they're a pretty neat whale. And you often find them associated with these big sort of workups. So you'll get gannets and common dolphins and shags and, you know, lots of different species that are feeding on fish all together, working together. And then a brood as well will come right through the middle of it and just go off and take the whole lot. and all the birds and all the dolphins like, oh, because all the fish have gone, like the school of fish have gone. So brooders, I think, you know, I don't know if other animals can swear, but I'm sure they do when a brood as well comes through and takes all the food after all the hard work by the dolphins. But also increasingly we see the whales feeding just with, we call them plankton birds, little storm petrels and some of the smaller shearwaters that just taking plankton off the surface. And we see the brooders feeding like that. And we did a big study on their poo to work out what they were eating, because we don't often see what's going in their mouth because the Gulf's so productive. It's with phytoplankton, so you don't often see what they're feeding on. So they're a pretty neat whale, you know. They manage to live here and hang out here. Some of them, you know, head further north and offshore. They're not always just here. But the population, it's around about 140 animals use this broader Hauraki Gulf, Te Kapa Moana, Te Whanganui, Atoi region. So it's a very, very important place for them in New Zealand.
We're talking a bit about the environment they need to survive, the kind of kai that they need to eat, the way that that's actually changed given the habitat that they're in. Can you share with me what is your view of the current state of the Hauraki Gulf?
Well, that's a good question. We really take it for granted. So the Hauraki Gulf has its own act of law. It's a marine park. It's a protected area. And in 2000, it was designated as such. We know that early Pacific voyagers and Maori, you know, who settled here, you know, knew there was a lot of kai here, a lot of food, and there's some really interesting historical recollections and, you know, stories around just the wealth of seafood, fish, mussels, whales, dolphins, seals, seabirds. You know, there was a lot of food, and people have you know, slowly worked their way through a lot of those animals as food, and combined with things happening in other places, not just the Gulf. So, for example, seals were hunted really heavily. That means we no longer have the fur seals around here. They're slowly recovering, but nothing like they used to be. And so the Gulf is a really changed place over the last few hundred years. But I guess over the last 50 years, it's been dramatically altered, with more people living in the city. Like about a third of New Zealand lives around the Hauraki Gulf coast and area, which is a lot of people by New Zealand standards. Mm. And so, you know, land development, runoff, you know, sediment buildup, outfalls of, you know, sewage, even, you know, we're just trying to keep up with that basic infrastructure is really hard with a rapidly growing city. And in addition, you know, we have a lot of fisheries. So there's recreational, commercial and customary fishing, because there's a lot of people live here and catching a fish is a thing we do. So there's an immense amount of pressure on the Hauraki Gulf, plus natural disease events and unnatural ones that have come through. In the late 90s, there was a pilchard bait imported from Australia, brought in herpes virus, and that wiped out a lot of the pilchards. And we think that might be one of the drivers behind the whales' shift in prey, you know, to eating more zooplankton. You know, so there's a lot of pressures on this place because there's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And we're not very respectful of this place, and we need to actually just really stop and have a good hard look at ourselves, because it's on us.
Matt, I want to introduce you to the conversation, because when we're talking about the current state of the Gulf, the port gets a lot of flack. Can you share with me, from your perspective, what is the current state of the Hauraki Gulf?
Yeah, so my knowledge is a bit shallower than Rochelle's. I more dabble around the edges of the Gulf and go swimming in it. I don't do a lot of fishing. I have been out once or twice to, you know, on the back of a boat to see if I could catch a fish, very unsuccessfully. So for me, it's very much based around the recreational. I love swimming in the Gulf. It's absolutely fantastic, and we have such a treasure. I remember when I came back from London, I almost felt like I was on holiday every single day, because you come home from work and you can go for a walk along the beach pretty much anywhere that you live in Auckland. And as you drive around Auckland, you always see the sea. It's an amazing city, really. Mm. When you look at it that way. From a general state of the Gulf point of view, from the port's point of view, we have more of an impact in the inner Waitemata Harbour. And then even that, a lot of it is because of the runoff that comes down from the city. And it comes out through old infrastructure and just pours out actually in between some of our wharves, and that is not a good impact. Some of that sediment and thing that comes through, we generally have to dredge that out again because it settles all around the port, and at the moment that's all locked up in our reclamation, which is quite good. We also have ships coming in and out of the port, and that was there's not a huge number of ships, actually. There's a lot fewer than you would think, and they're getting less in number as ships get bigger. So each ship carries more freight, so you need fewer ships to come in and out to carry actually more freight. So that's been a trend for some time. But that's, you know, that's how I became involved in this whole project around the Brutus Whale, was when Rochelle called together the group. She saw what was happening. And called together a big group to see what could be done about ship strike through the Hauraki Gulf. And then I guess the final thing that I see through this and through other involvement in things on the Gulf is, as a new Aucklander, I've sort of learned a lot more about the islands. I mean, they're basically invisible to a lot of people unless you happen to own a boat yourself. So it's been a fantastic learning experience. Mm-hmm. through the work that I've done with Rochelle and through the Sea Change project. I was on that group for a while. And you can really see the human impact on the Gulf generally, you know, like the just destruction of the mussel beds, which was just terrible. And I love the work that's being done to try and assist that. And maybe, hopefully, fingers crossed, the port can be involved in some of that as well through shell hash that we dig out from the channel, which makes the shipping channel shallower. But maybe we can reuse that to try and help reform beds that mussels could establish on. And then the recreational fishing, I think that's a really interesting one. It's a real case of the tragedy of the commons. You know, you go out and, I only caught a couple of fish and that's fine. But then you didn't see the other thousands of people that go out every single
caught the
day.
Caught same couple and of fish, yeah.
It's relentless. And I really hear that call from Rochelle that and from a lot of people that we just need to give it a break. I mean, you know, when we had lockdown level 4 and the system got a break, I remember going out swimming when we could in level 3 and there still weren't all the recreational boats out there. And I just sunk down under the water and listened and it was quiet. And normally you hear that all the time, constantly. And how cool must that have been for all the creatures that live there? So, yeah, we do need to give the place a break. We need better systems. There are now too many of us living in the Auckland region. And we're individually, okay, we're only doing our little thing, but collectively we're having a big impact.
And I want to talk about your collective impact, your specific collective impact. And you spoke a little bit about ship strike. And this is the issue that we have with Brutus whales, is that they were being killed because they were being hit by ships. And so hence the connection between the two of you and this kaupapa around helping to stop that from happening moving forward. So Rochelle, you were the one who made the call and gave Matt a call. Can you tell me a little bit about what was happening and what drove you to calling this group of people together?
We had been collecting, you know, information about stranded whales for some time. The Department of Conservation took that on in the late 1980s, and I had a student who was sort of pulled together all of the records of the whales, because I was like, this doesn't seem right. You know, these animals have injuries and are washing up in numbers that, you know, may not be okay. So she pulled together all the information that was around the broader area. So Ngāti Wai up off Whangarei area, they have a protocol. They deal with all the necropsies of the whales. So they have tikanga in place and do that. So they had a bunch of records. Department of Conservation had records and council people had some. We pulled it together and it was like, wow, these injuries don't look good. And I contacted my colleagues, in particular Michael Moore, who deals with the North Atlantic right whale ship strike issue, which is a huge tragedy. And I sent him the photos and records, and he goes, yeah, some of these here, these whales definitely have been hit and killed by ships. So that, I was like, all right, what do we need to do to fix it? I'm a fixer. You know, if I have a problem, I'm like, who do we need to pull together to solve this problem? We don't have time. Conservation, you don't have time. So we worked out that there were just over 2 whales a year being killed because of ship strike. There were almost certainly more, which was adding about 50% more to their natural mortality rate. We also knew that the population was quite small. And so that added, you know, another urgency to it. They have the highest threatened species listing in New Zealand. So that, you know, even highlights even more the call to action. So I got together DOC, Department of Conservation, Council, ports people, fishing people, anyone I could think of, iwi, you know, who would have some interest in these whales, operate on the water, the whale watch boat, ferry companies, everyone. And I said, we have a thing going on here. And we were lucky to have Michael come over from the US, and he sat down and just walked everyone through it, what was needed, because it was very important to me that the evidence we had was quite slim. you know, just a few photos and maybe odd markings. So he stressed the urgency and the importance of undertaking a necropsy. So that meant, you know, to cut the whale up until we could determine the cause of death. So I got Stu Hunter, who's a veterinary pathologist from Massey University. He joined us, and Craig Pritchard, who's at the zoo at the time. They're both vets. And so when a whale came ashore or was found floating, we were really lucky that local hapū from around the Hauraki Gulf region all understood the urgency and gave permission for us to necropsy these taonga. Like, you know, for Māori, these are ancestors. These whales are very important in their history and their narrative. And it was really important for us to be able to ascertain cause of death so that when we asked the ships to slow down, we knew it was because they had been hit. You know, the whale had died because of ship strike. So it just sort of took off from there. And then there was just this really nice core group of people who got together, the Environmental Defence Society, Hauraki Gulf Forum. Matt sort of took the main role from Ports of Auckland, and myself leading the science, plus others. Some sort of came and went at different times. But there was just this little core of probably about five of us who just kept the thing moving along. And at the very first meeting, you know, the kaupapa of the group, the reason why we gathered was dead whales. And we all agreed we didn't want dead whales. So we then had to work out how to do that. And it was interesting beginning because some of the, you know, shipping companies and some of the people within the ports were just like, you do realize that we're a multi, you know, million-dollar industry. This is very important to the economy. And I'm like, yeah, I understand that, but you can't hit and kill whales with your ships because there are potential solutions. And we stood on the shoulders of giants. You know, there were two main routes we could go. We could get ships to slow down, or we could get them to reroute. So, you know, go away where the whales weren't. And so, you know, when we started off, there was a lot of leaning back and folding arms and sort of giving the side eye at each other sometimes. You know, it's like, who is this person? But what, like I said, just that really simple thing that none of us wanted dead whales was just what we kept our eye on. And so the other thing that was really critical for moving the whole thing forward was that we all had different tasks. You know, like I was the science, Matt and the ports became through to all the shipping companies. And, you know, that's a really interesting part. Matt, we'll talk to that. Also, EDS had like the legal frameworks. Should we go down a legal route? We've got, you know, we could get a marine mammal protected area, and we've got this coastal plan, and there's lots of laws and rules that, you know, could have been implemented. And international rules through the International Maritime Organization, which is often used overseas to manage ship strike of whales. So we all had tasks, and every time we met, we had to do something. And so when we came back next time, we'd moved forward, you know, we'd made progress. And anyone new to the group had to catch up. All the minutes and notes were all publicly available. We didn't look back ever. We had no time to look back. We had to keep moving forward to solve the issue. So there was some really cool science that helped us with that. You know, the obvious question is like, why don't they just get out of the way? Can't they hear the ship coming? So we put these suction cup tags on the whales. Mark Johnson, a colleague of mine, is now at the University of Oahu, said designed them. He's a Kiwi, designed them. And they're such cool tags. And we knew everything the whales were doing. That's how we know that they sleep at night and feed in the day. But what we found is that they spend 91% of their time between the surface of the water and about 12 meters down, which is where most of the ship draft, you know, so the depth of the ship's cover. So those whales spent most of their time in the potential strike zone of ships coming through. They weren't down at the bottom of the water. They were a high risk, even though there weren't many of them. So some cool science was you know, really pivotal in informing our move forward.
And so the solution, so there were the two options, the rerouting or the slowing down, and the slowing down seemed to be the solution that people agreed on, yeah, or the solution that worked.
Yeah, well, Matt can talk to this maybe because it was him.
what was the solution, Matt?
Well, It was a long process. And look, I think it's fair to say that Ports of Auckland and the shipping industry were, you know, they weren't familiar with this. I mean, the reason I got involved in this whole project is, you know, as Rochelle said, no one wants to kill a whale. Oh, killing whales is bad PR. Oh, let's get the PR guy in, see if he can do something about this. So it was myself and another chap who I have to give a shout out to, Wayne Mills, who were on the group. And Wayne was also very instrumental in everything that we did. So, I mean, I was just thinking about this. It's almost like that five stages of grief that you have to go through. And the first one's denial, isn't it? And we're like, oh no, I know we don't want to kill whales, but surely there's some other way we can do this without slowing down the ships because, oh, that's going to cost a lot of money. Oh, and it did take us a bit of a while to actually, you know, to consider all the science. We had to do our own report, which looked at the cost of slowing down ships and how many hours that would add to timetables. And, you know, it was a couple of hours because over the distance of the Gulf and the area that was proposed to slow down, it was a reasonable amount. And when you add up that time and how the ships would then have to go faster to make up that time to get to the next port, there are costs involved. But we did look at the problem. We looked at all the other alternatives. You know, was there a way we could warn the whales or spot them with thermal imaging or change the routes or put a lookout on the ship? We even tried, the warning system so that the whales, if someone spotted a whale, they'd phone it in to harbour control and harbour control would alert the ships coming in and say, watch out for the whale, it's seen at XYZ. But nothing really seemed to work as well as slowing down. So it did take us, the industry, a while to accept that was the thing that we needed to do to slow down the ships. And then it took a little while just to organise everything. So I remember I drafted a protocol. I did a little bit of research on the internet, came up with some words, and we drafted this protocol and we sent it out to all the different shipping lines and the agents and things. But it's first of all, it's an international industry. So the head offices are overseas and there's all sorts of people spread all around the world. It's very fragmented. There is coastal shipping, there are ro-ro shipping or multi-cargo type shipping, bulk ships, container ships. They all have different lines. They all have different agencies. And just trying to get that message out to all of the different groups involved, even though we had people here in New Zealand who were involved in the process and came along to the meetings and were very supportive, still trying to get that message out to people was difficult. But, you know, we went through sort of ups and downs. I think there was a point, was it 2014, and a whale was killed? And that was like, oh my God, it's happened again.
That's terrible.
How are we going to, yeah, that's right. And that added a bit of urgency and impetus into getting a resolution. The other thing that shipping lines really don't like is international regulation. It's very unwieldy. It can create rules that aren't flexible and don't allow ships to try and keep to their timetables. One of the things with shipping is so unpredictable. You know, there'll be a storm overseas, there'll be delay at another port. Who knows what? There's some problem with loading freight in somewhere else. I mean, you see it at the moment under COVID. Shipping's all over the place. So there is a need for some flexibility in whatever the solution is to enable shipping to, you know, to continue in a practical sense. So that with that impetus, with that desire not to go down the regulatory route, you know, the other reason for that is it costs a lot of money and there probably would have been a great big fight that would have taken 5-10 years to get anything done. So as an industry, we came around to that idea of, okay, let's look at a speed limit, let's make it voluntary, and then let's see what we can do as an industry to make sure that we're all towing the line and adhering to it. And there was an attempt, again, through some of your friends overseas, or expert friends overseas, mm-hmm. Rochelle, when we did the tracking and produced all that very clever stuff. But we found that
we actually had a local method that worked pretty well to keep to monitor the ship speeds, so that the shipping lines themselves could see, okay, that ship that belonged to our line went through fast. We can have a chat to the captain. We can find out which ship sped in a timely manner and get onto it and then change it for the next voyage. One of the key things was getting the help of the sort of peak bodies. So the it's called the International Container Lines Committee is for the container shipping. So that's kind of like a peak group. And they were able to help the communication with their members. And similarly for the other cargo types, there are peak bodies, and we were able to get them involved. And I've got to take my hat off to Wayne Mills. He is a pilot himself, so he's one of the people that goes on ships to bring them into harbour. And he helped with the pilots, and the pilots would go on board and say to the master, are you aware of the protocol for slowing down? And if the answer was yes, well, that's great, Captain. And if it's not, well, then, you know, here is some education, and this is what you should do, and this is what you need to do next time. And then involving those officers overseas and getting them, you know, really on board and telling their ships what to do when they came in. So that whole collective, I mean, it did take a little while, didn't it, Rochelle? It wasn't overnight.
It takes a while.
It did take a while. But you know, the result was fantastic. We did a survey of ship speeds way back before anything happened, and I think it was 14.2 knots.
That's right.
On average, and that average now sits at around 10 knots, sometimes lower, sometimes slightly above. But it's exactly where we want it to be, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it is.
And you said that. You said there was a sense of urgency in 2014 because another whale had been hit. How many whales have been hit since then?
None. None in the Hauraki Gulf.
I mean, in this particular area.
Yeah.
Sorry, not around the world. Just in this particular
sometimes.
Area.
Well, sometimes.
It's working?
Yep, it works. And it's all voluntary. Yes. I mean, it really, I think it's one of New Zealand's greatest conservation wins, to be honest, that lots of people don't really know about. One of the things, you know, like Matt said, it took a long time. But when I look at my colleagues overseas, we were very fast, literally within 2.5 years of us getting this whole process going, the research results come in. The ships had slowed down. So within 2.5 years from really knowing all of the working parts, we had a solution to it. And I mean, it was really impressive. You know, they had to slow down. It was the only real option because rerouting traffic, the whales go everywhere and anywhere, depending on where their food is. So that didn't make sense. You know, moving the ships one place, they'd need to move again, perhaps the next day even. So the slowing down was the most important thing. And also I think the industry sort of reconciling with the fact that this was going to cost them something. That, you know, there's a financial cost to it. But with voyage planning and that, I think, you know, they've managed to, well, hopefully absorb it and clearly absorb it in some way, which, you know, I'm hugely grateful for. And I think that's quite important. You know, my helpful suggestion, because I'm a scientist, was that perhaps the $2 shop could become the $3 shop to make up the shortfall. But it wasn't picked up. You know, clearly I have no idea why I'm not in business, you know. No. but you know, the cost has to come somewhere, ultimately. Yeah. But
I do want to pick up on something that you did say, though, which is this is one of the greatest conservation success stories that we've had in Aotearoa. Yeah. And it was one that was done from the grassroots. It was one, not only were the ships voluntarily slowing down, but you were all voluntarily creating solutions to this issue. And as you both pointed out, it wasn't something that you waited for government legislation or council legislation or these other governing bodies to come in and make decisions about. You did it because you had essentially had the power to do it through the industry that you're in. You had the knowledge and the science to back it up, and you had that willingness to collaborate. And often success comes right down to just that one thing, willingness, the willingness to do something. And So to commend you both and your teams on the success, but to also ask, was it harder because you didn't have those legislative bodies on board, or not necessarily on board, but part of the process? Or was it easier because you could make decisions directly with those who were involved and progress at the pace that you needed to go without waiting for decisions elsewhere to be made by people who may not be familiar with the region or the area or the, you know, the places that we're talking about?
I think it was definitely easier. You know, I have no doubt about that. I wasn't really in favour of a legislated or, you know, a sort of law or regulation to be put in place, partly because these are wild animals and at any time they can just up and move wherever they want. We've seen that off California, and we've seen it certainly with the North Atlantic right whales. They've got, in some areas, they had fully protected and no right whales because of prey movements. And so that didn't make sense to me. Also, it would have taken 3+, at a minimum, 3 years to get anything in place. We didn't have 3 years. That was 60 whales, you know, in our currency. So I, hands down, think it was faster, more effective. That sort of, you know, that social process that we ran where there was a collective ownership of it, of the problem and the solution, never underestimate that. You know, and so Taranga, the whale who was our last whale, died in September 2014 here at Te Arai. He washed up. And, you know, as Matt said, that was kind of a big wake-up call for all of us. And we reported what happened to him, how he died, and the injuries to him. And that's really confronting for people. Like, it's confronting for me as a scientist who's seen it a lot, but standing up there and telling people, you know, in the group, the working group, what actually, how this whale died and what happened to it. It's akin to a human being hit by a car, just traumatic injuries. And the faster you go, which the ships were initially, the more traumatic the injury. And so that stuff, you can just articulate that fast, and you've got a bunch of people who are already leaning in. You know, we're all on board. That means that you have the sort of heart-mind connection and ownership over the problem and the solution. So it was much faster. And what it also means is, like, you know, literally since 2014, there's, you know, that last whale in 2014, there's been no ship-struck dead whales in the Gulf. So that's, gosh, what's that now? It's like about 15 whales that are alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be dead had we not done this. Like 15 whales. When I go out there now and I see them, I'm like, you're alive because the ships slow down and have done since 2014. And I mean, you cannot underestimate the power of that. And I think every single day, the shipping industry and people involved in all of this process, but even now, are proud of themselves, even quietly. Mm. And it's actually not even a problem now. We don't really think about it, do we, Matt? It's just like, no. It works, you know? We look at it from time to time, but it works. And we would not even have any legislation or anything in place by now that would be useful, I don't think. We'd still be arguing.
So I'd like to really strongly support that and just make an additional comment. You know, yes, we absolutely got things in much faster and it was much easier. But if we'd gone down some kind of a confrontational route through legislation, I don't think Rochelle and I would be sitting here being mates and talking about this project in such a nice way. And it's such a really good advertisement for a collaborative process, which is what we use. So I'm a total convert to that. Yeah, it takes a little bit of talking and, you know, you have to have some difficult conversations, but you get a solution much faster and one that's lasting. You know, this isn't where people have been dragged in reluctantly and are sort of towing the line because there's a big stick behind them and if they find a shortcut, they'll use it. We do it now. That's part of our practice. Everyone complies willingly. And it's a great result. So, yeah, it's absolutely the best way to go. It's much better to sit down and talk with people than to just shout at each other, always.
And it's something that I want to ask you both. What does this mean for other challenges that we face in the Gulf? Because there are lots of others that may not directly involve either of you, or they might. And when we look at solutions and we look at restoring the Māori of the Gulf, and we're looking at, te kapa moana, te moana nui o toi, to be a thriving marine environment, there's lots of work that still needs to be done. You've both spoken about how effective it has been to, A, find something that you can agree on. Nobody wants a dead whale. So you've been able to do that. And then work creatively to finding solutions, which aren't always it isn't always an agreeable process, but get to the point where you can find solutions that work and do so together. What advice or what tips do you have for other areas of the Gulf? Because there are many other challenges that are being faced, and not everybody wants to come to the table. And when I think about grassroots community, often they will want to come to the table. And when I think about big industry, often they won't. And that's mostly because some of the things that we've discussed today around how it's going to affect the business, how it's going to affect the economy, like some of these really big effects that it can have for them to come to the table, but also maybe it's not as important to one group as it is to another, whether they're a big industry or not. What's some tips that you guys have coming from the perspectives that you do?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think just talking about industry, sometimes it can be easier to get industry to the table because I think businesses are more sensitive to external perception. And never forget that, big industry is just people like us. It's not It's not some artificial construct outside of humans. It's people. And the people within those businesses, they go fishing or they go swimming or sailing or whatever else it might be, and they see the same effects and they have the same feelings and they want to do good things. So I think that industry can sometimes make it easier because you have a specific group in a specific place that does have a concern, either collectively because of the people or as a business itself, about its image or about the way it behaves, and it wants to do good in that sense. Probably one of the harder areas are those really amorphous areas where you might have a large group of people, and I don't want to pick on recreational fishers, but just, that's one group where it is such a big group. How do you get everybody collectively at mm-hmm. the table? And that might not be an unwillingness. It's just that it's a very spread and dispersed group.
Just a practicality.
And maybe that is by approaching different organisations like your legacies, but also the boating clubs that many of those people belong to. And working with those groups, so that sort of umbrella organisations, in the way that when we really got the help of the shipping line umbrella organisations, that gave us a boost and helped us to accelerate things and reach a resolution. And then I guess, sometimes it can be a bit of luck. Rochelle, it was having you there to identify the problem and then to bring the right people together was good fortune. And that we got good people on that group who really wanted to come to a problem, come to a solution. And I think, we developed a trust on that group despite the fact we're all from different areas and different viewpoints. And there was no sort of undermining or saying something to the group and then going off and doing something different. Developing that trust is really important. I have seen situations where if you just don't have that trust, then that collaborative process can't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think trust is a really critical. It's a necessity in making change and making effective change. I liken it kind of a little bit like a family. You don't always have to get on and you can have some fights, but ultimately you're all in it together, your family, like your whānau. And I think creating that sort of sense is quite important in solving some of these problems quickly. For the Hauraki Gulf, in the future, I don't think that the answers lie with regulatory bodies. I don't think it can lie with our Department of Conservation or our councils, or it has to lie with people. And one thing that I'm really excited about is there's a huge number of different hapu and iwi, you know, Māori groups within the broader Hauraki region, Hauraki Gulf region. But as they, you know, get treaty settlements and become more confident and assured in their place within the Hauraki Gulf, they can play a huge role, I think, in shifting the dial. And Ngāti Poa's, you know, marine protected, or sort of the rahui, sorry, which is a kind of marine protection placed around Waiheke Island, was, you know, so exciting for me to see that, because, you know, those are the steps that I think are going to move us forward. And that, you know, sure, Ngāti Poa, you know, as Māori group did that, but there are many, many, many people who are, who live here, who completely agree with that and know that we have to have that to try and take our foot off the pedal, you know, the gas pedal for the Hauraki Gulf. And so the more that we can have these community approaches towards action that affect change, the Gulf will heal from that. The marine environment is incredibly resilient. You know, you don't have to go out there and plant a whole bunch of things and that, like on land, you know, there's no tree planting required. It literally, the ocean will heal itself if you give it the space to do that, and it will restore itself. And, you know, over the course of even only a few years, 10 years, you will see meaningful change. And we know that from the very few protected areas we have in the Gulf. And so I think that's going to be key, is that the people who live in and around and of this place make the difference. I think the other thing that is always a real challenge with the ocean is we don't really see the ocean. If we go anywhere near it, we might have a quick swim, or we might be on a boat and we sit on it and we can't see under it. And so I'm really excited about some of the efforts being made, NZVR, the virtual reality project, where they're going and filming these degraded habitats and then filming, you know, pristine habitats and using virtual reality. So, you know, anyone can access, anyone can go for a swim in the Hauraki Gulf at some of our most polluted places or some of our most beautiful pristine places. And they can see that. And it's not everyone who sees that goes, oh my gosh, I don't want that. I want that. And that then allows that conversation. So, you know, kāpai and, you know, awesome to those teams of people who are trying to bring under the water into the homes of people. And I think that's a massive step forward. I think my final thing would be, you know, we need to work out in this area, who is that group of people that's going to shift the dial for te kapa moana, te moana nui atoe? You know, it's not just Māori, it's not just the scientist, it's not just the industry, you know, it's actually who are those key people, like we formed for this group, you know, around the ship strike, who are those key faces and people that actually want to move forward and keep going? Baggage, your personal baggage gets left, you're doing it for that space. You know, it's such a remarkable piece of ocean, and we need to be a lot more thoughtful about it and kind to it.
When we think of the effect that this mahi has had on the Brutus whale, and we think of the win and the significant positive effect it has had on the lives of these whales by slowing ships down, what other challenges are facing our tohora, our whales, in the Hauraki Gulf? Because this is one thing, this is one significant thing that was taking lives of whales. But are there other things that are affecting the Brutus whales in the Hauraki Gulf that we need to start thinking about as well?
The main one will be climate change. Climate change is likely to shift their food. We've done recently a study and shown in those anomalously warm years where it's, you know, slightly warmer than normal, we get them around the sort of El Nino Southern Oscillation events and the warm blob, as it was affectionately known a few years ago, which was just this random warm event. We're getting more of those. When that happens, the prey moves, the dynamics of the Gulf and the beginning of the food chain shifts. And because these whales need a lot of food, they move. So one of my things that I keep my eye on is that the whales move further out in the outer regions of the Gulf, and potentially they could move into those waters where we don't have the slow area. It hasn't happened yet, but it may be something we need to consider. Most importantly, though, is that change to their prey. If there's not the food, then that affects the whole food chain. It's not just the whales, it's all of the things. The seabirds, we're already seeing with a lot of our manu, our seabirds, they have to fly further to find food. If they get there and there's not enough food, and then they come back, they don't have enough energy or food left to feed their chick, so their chick dies because the parent has spent all the time flying using the energy, so there's to these kinds of dynamics. And if it's happening with the big things that I think are really useful for telling stories to people to understand the Gulf, then, it's having a huge impact on the small things as well. We know that for a fact. So, climate change would be my biggest one. And of course, things like extraction of key prey. We shouldn't have a fishery here. It's small now compared to what it was, but we shouldn't have a fishery for pilchards and jack mackerel and souri, those little mid-water sort of fishes. They often get called bait fish in New Zealand, and there's nothing that makes me more cranky than referring to those fish as bait fish, because they're actually not bait and they're not cat food. They are a core part of the ecosystem within the Gulf, transferring that energy from smaller things to bigger animals. They are critical. And anyone who's been in the Gulf for a long time will tell you that the loss of those, there's been, significant loss. So, looking after the food is really positive, not necessarily for the brooders whales, but for other whales, as we are going to see, and we are slowly seeing more humpback whales, because now we know when hunting them, they're slowly recovering. And southern right whales, and they're going to come back, and we'll see them here in the Gulf. Like, there was a whaling station on Aotea, on Great Barrier Island, for many years, and it shut down. I think it was in the 60s when the whale stocks collapsed. So there were a lot of whales used to go past here, and we're going to see them again. And those are really important. They are such a critical part of the Pacific voyaging narratives, and people who live around the coasts of New Zealand. Whales have always, tohora, have always been a very important part of our history. So, they'll come back slowly.
And that does take me to our future. It does take me to what it is that you hope to see. So you've both done mahi in this space that has had significant impact, and you're both continuing to do mahi in this space from your various positions around the health and wellness and the ongoing use of the Hauraki Gulf in its various forms. Matt, I want to ask you, what is your hope for the future of the Hauraki Gulf?
Well, I have personal hopes, and also hopes for Ports of Auckland as a business. I personally happen to think that the port is located in the right place and that it will be here for a long time. I know there's a lot of debate around that, but I'm a strong believer that it's better not to dig up another part of the coastline to have a port. It's better to use the bit that we've already dug up. But I'd like to see us, and I know that there is a very strong willingness and commitment amongst the people here at the port to help and to do what we can to, A, improve our own operations so that we don't contribute anything that is to the detriment of the Gulf, but also that we can do things that help restore the Māori of the Gulf. Mm. And, at the moment we're in that phase of having a look around to see where it is that we can best contribute, and that might be in resources, it might be in projects that we can do in association with some of the works that we have to do. So, for example, we need to deepen our channel because we are no longer reclaiming, or we're going to stop reclaiming. We have to dispose of that fill somewhere, and it has to go offshore. Most of it's clean, it's dug up from the bottom of the channel, and it goes a long way offshore. Okay, that's great, but what could we do with that material that's dug up that could actually be beneficial I talked a bit earlier about some of that material being shell hash, and can we work with muscle restoration groups or Ngāti Whātua, who are working in close in to Auckland, looking at ways to restore the muscles. And so we're really hopeful that we'll find ways of using at least some of that material that can be beneficial. And then there may be other projects that we can be involved in. And like I say, there are a lot of people in the port. We're just Aucklanders, you know. We're the same as everyone else around here. And there are a number of people in key positions who want to push that forward. We're also particularly interested in what we might be able to do with sea change to actually bring that to life. I mean, I know that there's work going ahead with government around that, but we want to find ways that, even if it's just small projects, that we can do things to help and that push that project, that kaupapa, forward. And personally, I've really grown to love the Gulf as I've lived here in Auckland. I've learned a lot more about the Gulf Islands and about the waters. And I'd love to see it start to be restored to what it used to be. And I think we can do that. So I will be looking around and doing my bit where I can, just on a personal level, to help bring that about.
And what about you, Rochelle? What do you hope to see, and what do you hope to be the Hauraki Gulf to be in the future?
I would like to see the Hauraki Gulf the vibrant, amazing place it was when people first arrived here. You know, I'm not about, you know, going back in time and creating exactly what we used to have. You know, we can't do that. But I think we can have, this place could be so much better if we just stopped and thought about the Gulf before we thought about ourselves. It's, you know, we are the solution to all of the problems that the Gulf has. It's just that simple. So anytime anyone, you know, chucks something down the drain, that's going to the Gulf. Anytime anyone takes a fish out of the water, that's going to the Gulf. Anytime someone leaves their rubbish, lets it blow away, doesn't pick it up, that's going into the Gulf, you know. And so it's, if we could just switch that, just stop and go, what does this mean for the Gulf? I think that for me would be like a massive leap forward, and those simple mindful acts would make a difference to the place. I would really like to see that we actually treat it like the national treasure that it is. You know, it's a marine park for a reason, and we need to stop treating it badly. So that requires an attitude shift. I would also like to see the good news stories celebrated. There's some amazing stuff going out there. Like there's some of the fishing industry responses to mitigating, you know, seabird bycatch. It's incredible. You know, why are we not celebrating that? And, you know, there's a number of really cool initiatives going on that need to be celebrated. You know, it's not just all about fishing. I get so tired just hearing, oh, well, it's my right to catch a fish. You know, as I often teach my students, it's like, it's my right to know that those fish are in the Gulf. That's as equally as important as your right to catch that fish. You know, so we need to just stop and think. That's all I want. If we stop and think, things will get better. They will.
Some people might have been listening to this podcast today, and this might have been the first time they'd ever learned about Brutus whales. And I would like to give them the opportunity to learn a little bit more. Where might they be able to find some information about Brutus whales? Is there a website, or is there... I guess maybe because I'm on Zoom, I can see both of your faces, and those that are listening are like, why are you still talking? But it's because they're both freaking out slightly because they're not quite prepared to say this is where you can find it. the benefit of being able to see the people I'm talking to. And so that's okay. If there's not a specific website, how about we share how this word is spelt? Because not many people are going to, they're going to go and try and Google search maybe and think how they're going to spell it. So how do we spell Brutus whales?
It's a capital BRYDE apostrophe S. It's named after a Norwegian.
Kapai. So if you do want to find out more information about these spectacular tohora, then go and do a Google search and just ensure you've got the correct spelling so that you know what it is that you're looking at. We've come to the end of our kōrero, and it has been really great to get to hear about this initiative that you've both been a part of. It's been so beautiful to hear of the collaboration that you've been able to have in this group that has scientists and industry and comms people and all these different elements that have come together to ensure that we haven't had any more, well, so far, and fingers crossed it continues like that, haven't had any more whales killed by ship strike, which is absolutely spectacular. It's a really great achievement. And so congratulations to you both and to your teams for this group. So thank you so much for your kōrero with us today. We have lots more kōrero coming up on the Hauraki Golf podcast series. All of them are great stories about groups, individuals, iwi, people all around the Hauraki Golf Marine Park area who are doing great things for Te Kapa Moana, for Te Moana Nui Atoi, for the Hauraki Golf Marine Park. So tēnā kōrua, thank you so much for sharing today, and I look forward to meeting you both a tinana in person in future. So tēnā koe.
Tēnā koe.
Thank you, Kiana.